Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi. Armin couldn't make it today because of time zone differences, and our guest is actually in Europe this time. So, you know, we've had to figure things out either way, right? So I want to get right to it. We actually have this is a comedian that I met last year in Amsterdam, and I have just been a fan of her ever since. So, Shabana Rahman Garter is a Pakistani Norwegian comedian. She was raised Muslim. Now she calls herself a freethinker. She's been featured in the New York Times. She's been featured in Time Magazine. She's known for humor that is shocking, but always has wit and always has purpose. And it's actually very, very intelligent. Most famously, what she did was like, this is the incident, I think, Shabana, is when you lifted an Islamic leader, a fundamentalist Islamic leader, off the ground during a public debate, just to show that, okay, if he can be lifted, he can't be that harmful, which was hilarious. It infuriated him, it emasculated him, and he complained to the police, but it didn't go anywhere, as it shouldn't. So she's brilliant, she's biting, she's hilarious. And Shabana is here, and she's joining us on the podcast. Welcome, Shabana. It's an honor to speak to you.
Thank you. Hello from Oslo. Hi,
so that's everyone. Yeah, that's great. So I got to ask you something. We've had some, you know, like I'm a big stand-up comedy fan and just comedy fan in general. And we've had several on this show. We've had, you know, Jafar Khan has been on here. From New York. We've had Vidu Vids from the UK is pretty well known, you know, Vidu. And then we've also had Mohamed El Sheikhi. Mohamed is he's a Libyan comedian from Benghazi, and he kind of made it really big in the US. And now over the last 2 years, now he's writing for Full Frontal with Samantha Bee. Wow. So we've had these people, they're all from Muslim backgrounds, just like you are. What is it? But the comedians who come from Muslim backgrounds always end up being, you know, ex-Muslims or free thinkers, secular. What is it about comedy that makes you that way? Or are you that way? That's why you go into comedy. Which is it?
Yeah, it's a good question, Ali. And I don't think you become secular, you become free thinker. I think before being a comedian, before that persona get out of the closet, you are already there. You have always been there. Maybe you're not aware of that. If not, you have been an activist, maybe, yeah. and not a comedian. And I didn't choose comedy because I was like this good school girl who wanted to, you know, study maybe literature, or I actually wanted to be a teacher. So the comedy chose me, and I'm still running away from it. But you know, the thing you do and the way you see the world, and a lot of this is crazy stuff, and the way you put your word, your perspective on it, the world finds it funny. So it wasn't a career choice for me, but it became that way because that was the only stage where you could say and share the way you see the world, and the world finds it funny.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. The thing is, and it's not just people from Muslim backgrounds. It's Also, I mean, I've seen like Aziz Ansari, an atheist. He's an atheist to the extent that when the New York Times called him Muslim, he sent them a correction that they had to put a correction that, you know, he isn't Muslim. He identifies as an atheist. And then Kumail Nanjiani is another sort of Pakistani comedian. Also did stand up. He's doing movies. And he's also very, very secular. And it's not just the people from the Muslim backgrounds, but I think George Carlin, I remember George Carlin speaking so adamantly against religion as well, right? I mean, he was known for being like just a really biting critic of religion and faith. So it's always been a theme. You know,
yeah, and that's interesting, actually, because I was going to arrest you as well when you say she has this Muslim background, raised as a Muslim. And you know what? I thought it's okay, because, yeah, I wasn't raised as a Muslim. I come from a secular family. And my belief is that I never choose any religion. So why should I be identified as Muslim? But even though that this is my belief, but I was born in a Muslim family. I had this Muslim background. I speak Urdu. I have a family who said, inshallah, we have all this. So, you know, why say no to that? Why don't embrace it and see this is the way people from born in a Muslim family could also be? Mm-hmm. It's okay. So I think what most comedians, if we point out Muslim comedians, some of them, or maybe the reason it become a theme is that, you know, they don't want to have this tattoo with Muslim comedian on their forehead because, you know, because they want to be equal to all three comedians. They don't want to use this as their type or thing. Right. But I think I'm there now in my life that I'm thinking, why don't jump into it and see what comes out?
I like that. I think that one of the things that one of the most powerful ways to get this across, like, you know, people talk about diversity and everything all the time, is the diversity within the Muslim community is that, yes, you know, you've got the religious, conservative, those types of Muslims, but then you have people like yourself and people like me who are, you know, we just happen to be born into Muslim families, but the rest of it, we're all just human beings. And it's good for people to see that. It's good for, that is a more powerful way to dispel this whole stereotype of Muslims in the community than anything else, because there are a lot of us. I mean, people don't realize we just don't make the news as much. It's usually the crazies who make the news, but the majority of people out there are just regular people who just want to live their lives.
Yeah, and they're breaking the secular.
Yeah, and just like religion is, you know, in all the other religions, people are becoming less religious. Christians are becoming like the millennials, the younger generations are, I think over a third of them are not. And we've had polls out of Iran, out of Iraq, out of Saudi Arabia.
And you don't hear that. You don't hear that. Oh, you are not Christian anymore. So you are a comedian now, you know, but we hear that all the time. So have you left Islam? Yes, I have, but I never actually chose Islam. But yes, I'm born in a Muslim family. So there are differences way people are receiving comedians with much Muslim background. And I think we should look into that and still tell the world who we are and what we stand for. Yeah.
So how did you start? So you were born in Pakistan, right?
Yes.
And then
I was born in Karachi. Uh-huh. And I came to Norway when I was 2 years old. So I was raised in a very multicultural neighborhood in Oslo.
Right.
And for me, that was the normal. So when I started writing for a huge national newspaper as a columnist, I was 18 years old. Mm-hmm. And I have totally free pen, free writing. I just wrote my thoughts. But at that point, there weren't any other columnist with immigrant background in a national Norwegian paper. They were totally, you know, white writers.
Right. And
so I was surprised by that attention. This is a Pakistani girl. We are not observing them anymore. No, they are writing their thoughts. But it was before the bloggers and all that stuff.
Right, so yeah, yeah.
I'm old.
I think you were probably around the same age. You were born in the 70s? 70s kid?
Yeah, 76.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was born 75. I'm still
yeah.
old.
That's good. So, you know, in the 80s, it was very common in Norway to sunbath without anything on your upper body.
Right.
So I was my one of my first columns was about that, how it is to sunbathe naked.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
and you got the picture. And
yeah.
the reaction comes from Norwegians. Oh, my God, she's from Pakistan. We have never seen anyone sunbathing like this. But that was a total normal thing in the 80s in Norway. So I was receiving this attention, and I'm like, okay, this is my daily life. This is something I do. Yeah, my father might have slapped me if he watched me, but I was going to the beach and sunbathing like everyone else. But then I just continued to write, and I think my first column was a kind of stand-up funny stuff, but I didn't knew about stand-up comedy. So then I met another Pakistani comedian, and he had been a comedian since he was born. So we went to child school together. His name is Sahid Ali, one of Norway's most famous comedians. He invited me to his stand-up show, and I just loved it, because this was the stage I was missing. This was the voice I was missing. Growing up in a multicultural neighborhood with a public picture of us, which was really receiving us as totally strangers, but I didn't know any other country in Norway. So I thought, wow, I should write for that guy. I want to write comedy for him. And then he asked me, why don't you do it by yourself? So I had never, hold a microphone, or I was totally scared by the stage. And he said, okay, you just do it for 2 minutes. If it didn't work out, you can leave.
Yeah.
So I went up on stage, and one of my first lines was about some headlines were about Muslim girls who were traveling to Copenhagen to have suit on hymens,
Oh, just to get their hymens repaired, right? The virginity restoration. Yeah.
Yes. So they can have their arranged marriages or whatever. And the Norwegian media was describing these girls as liars. They lie. And, it was like, no. Why don't you ask why they are doing this? So my first joke was about, I grew up in Norway. I'm totally like every other Norwegian girl, except for one thing. I'm a virgin. But it's because I have suit on my hymen. So I have been fucking around. I have been in everything else. But when I'm tired of all that shit, and need a nice, suitable husband, I just do that. So it was a comment on what media was seeing. And that was this opening, and that was the start of my comedy. And it was something new, something fresh in the Norwegian comedy scene. And that leads to mullah lifting and mooning, and I don't know.
Yeah, everything. So let's pause for a second. So you did this first joke. This was your first stand-up gig. And how old are you at this time?
I was 23 years old.
23 years old. And how was it received?
Well,
reaction?
The reaction was actually, it was just a small headline in a local newspaper.
They loved it. So you killed right from the beginning.
Yes, right from the beginning. It was I was having my 2 minutes, and I was on the stage for 15 minutes at a sports bar where I had never been to before, and they invited me again, back again and again.
Wow.
And I totally scared and totally surprised. What happened now? What happened?
And then you got, not only did you get a great audience reaction, but then you also got a headline in the paper.
Yes, I received instant love and laughter.
Yeah.
And I realized that this audience, this society, they aren't against minorities. They aren't a racist nation. They are not excluding us. They need to hear our voices as we are. Our humor, our laughter, our heart, they're just waiting for it.
Right. This is where I think Kumail Nanjiani said, he's like, you know, we want to, I think, I can't remember exactly what he said, but he wanted to start like a Tumblr or some sort of blog just called Muslims Doing Boring Things, like having ice cream and just doing regular. He's like, we just need to do that so we can throw it out there that there's like just regular people, not everybody's like a religious maniac. You're just born into something. If you're born into something, that doesn't define who you are, right?
So
I love this. So you start this way, and then you get this instant love and appreciation. How do your parents react to this? Now they're reading about you in the paper, talking about sewing on your hymen back again, and you know all this, and they're obviously, you know, from Karachi, from Pakistan. So
yeah.
So how was that? Did they know? Did they react?
Well, my family knew me. They know how I was. So I have, you know, six brothers and sisters, and I'm in the middle, and I'm the crazy one. But I'm also the one who always was the person who, you know, was outspoken. So they weren't surprised. They just see, oh, it's her personality, and now it's on stage. Oh my God. But and I have already been columnist at the national newspaper. So I already, you know, they were used to me being in the media and hearing my voice. But my second show, my four brothers were at the audience.
Uh-huh.
And they applauded. And I was talking about one night stands and, you know, all that things in Norwegian girls do at 23 age, party and all that daily stuff. And then there was a TV station there, and they were filming me, and they were filming the audience, my brothers, and they were clapping. So the thing is that this got a huge attention. And you know why? Because the week before, one of Norway's biggest debate program had done this journalism on, and that was really awful. They were following a mother in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Where they went to the jail in Pakistan and interviewed a guy who have killed his sister at honor killing.
Right.
I think she was from Norway. So therefore a Norwegian film team went, a documentary team went to Pakistan. And from that jail, the brother was saying that he was honored to kill his sister. He was really honored, and that was the right thing to do. He didn't have any shame, and that was, you know, sent on prime time in Norwegian television in a situation where we still didn't knew each other, you know, as a society. That was the program sent a week before, and it was the same team who was audience watching my stand-up, which was only 15 minutes. It was my second show, and they wanted to interview my brother. Mm-hmm. How can you, as a Pakistani brother, see your sister on stage talking free like this and accept this and applaud it? Mm-hmm. And they asked me, could you please, you know, join this interview, your brother and with your brother? The first, I said no. I was like, oh no, I'm a comedian. I don't want to be this political commenter. No, 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 no.
Yeah.
I want to, you know, be seen with my art and all that stuff. And then I realized that, why not?
Mm-hmm.
Why not? Why being afraid of this? Why not make comedy out of this? Why not say it? And my brother agreed. And I think we were the first sisters and brother in, it must be any European TV station, where my brother was beside me and he said openly, this is my sister. Her honor is in her body. I don't own her honor. And it's okay. I love her. I want to protect her. But I don't own her voice, her body, her freedom. She can do whatever she wants. But then he also honestly said, I wasn't raised this way.
Yeah.
I was raised to follow them. I was raised to feel anger if they do something. Other people from the community will point on us. I was raised to take their hair and, you know, grab them at home if I didn't like it. I don't remember he was raised that way, but he never did that. But, you know, I have seen Pakistani girls in my neighborhood experience it. I have felt that my brother had this pressure on. And I was proud that he put word on it. And and then he explained, it came to a point where I got a girlfriend. She was at the same age as my sister, and I wanted to meet her. And I start thinking that, why can't she meet me and my sisters can? And these questions are sensitive. I hope they're not anymore, but this was in year 2000.
Yeah.
You know, this reflection on manhood, he did this on television. And after that, the criticism started. The death threats came.
Yeah. So I think that what he said, the reason that it's so important is that it acknowledges, as you said, it acknowledges both sides of these things. Because you usually see, you know, with especially with Pakistani or, you know, Muslim men or especially conservative men, actually not even liberal men, like just what they do is they're going to be like, okay, no, this is my sister. I have to protect her. She can't do this. Right. And they'll disapprove. Mm-hmm. Or on the other hand, the ones that are more sort of open will say, this is my sister. Look at us. We are Muslims too. And, you know, we are like this as well. And there's no problem anywhere. But he didn't do that. He first stood up for you and he said he doesn't own you. But then he also acknowledged that for him to start thinking this way took effort. It took reflection on the way he was raised. He had to actually break away from the way that he was raised. And I know that in your family, he probably wasn't raised that way. But as you said, within the community, the societal pressure, the kind of background that
The structure was there also in my family.
The structure is there, right. There is a pressure. There's the honor thing, right? Like where, you know, if you don't, I still get people, you know, telling me, you know, like, wait, why is your wife doing this? You know, keep your wife under control. And it's actually not even just from Muslim men. It's from like all kinds of things. There is a structure out there that tells, like, if there's a woman that's doing something that people don't like, they will write to her husband, they'll write to her father, they'll write to her brother, right? That why are you letting her do this?
Yes, you know? And if you don't have the reflection inside your family, you don't have, you know, the security to reflect openly, you will never get into that. You will start doing what others expect. And then you will also find excuses in your religion and your culture. We are this way. What is the problem? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And then you become that man who hurt your women in your family. And even women come that way. They're over-controlling it. And, you know, we are talking actually about double standards. You know? Yeah. And to go into that and accept it. Yes, there are double standards and I don't want to live this way. And this is how we are dealing with this. So we are, what we also did breakthrough, it's, you know, freedom of speech to discuss this openly. And it is okay. But in year 2000, it wasn't okay. You know, then you was a traitor or all that stuff, you know, already.
I think the visibility of people like yourself and other people from Pakistani Muslim backgrounds and in the comedy scene, in the arts, I think has probably been more powerful in dispelling or just at least heterogeneizing or whatever, if that's a word, like the experience, the perception of what people from backgrounds are. And I think that's important. It's not as important for people in the West to know. I mean, that doesn't matter as much. But I think what's really important for me is for young people to know that this is an option. For them to, you know, because I get that a lot. You know, when I wrote my book, when I started talking about these things, when I was growing up, I just knew that, okay, there were conservative Muslims, who were the mullahs, and then there were the liberal Muslims. And you have to be one of these. Right. There was no option of being out of this cult at all. And then, you know, now one of the most frequent things I hear from young people is that, oh, I didn't know that you could do this. I didn't know this was an option. You can also do this. You can leave. You can still do Eid and Ramadan, all that stuff with your parents and the say inshallah, whatever. You know, we still have that in our families. But, you know, you don't have to, it doesn't have to go with the burden of the ideology.
Yeah, and that I think that is a direct result of being visible. You know, it's funny because actually yesterday at the train station a very young Pakistani boy came to me and I had, you know, this mask on and corona and everything, and he was really polite, and he came to me and he said, are you Shabana? So yes, I grew up watching you, and I just have to say, I was full of hate when I grew up, you know, seeing you in the media. But now I have changed. Our culture needs freedom. He was so precise. I was like, what? Our culture needs freedom. Please go on with your work.
Isn't that the most moving thing, like when that happens, when
people up to you? I was almost crying because, then, you know, when people say that, especially young people, you know, you realized all that shit you have been through, you start remembering, and wow, this is the seeds, you know?
Yeah.
This is, keep thinking, keep acting. And then he just went away, but I wanted to ask him, what changed you? What did you experience?
That's right. Yeah, it's I think that's ultimately what matters. I mean, I've always heard, you know, I'm a physician, so we always talked about smoking cessation. How do you get people to quit smoking? People would say education, and then, you know, then you realize, I'm like, okay, well, you know, I'm a cancer pathologist, but I still smoke, right? Because I like it. If there's anybody for whom education would work as a deterrent, it would be me. But the place, education isn't actually very effective when it comes to these things, when it comes to habitual or addictive things. And I think that, you know, religious thinking and cultural indoctrination is very similar to that. But what works is that if the education is done before somebody even picks up a cigarette, right? So when you're a teenager, before you've started, that's when you get the education, and that prevents people from starting it in the first place. So
And part of that education could be that you are, you know, that people like you, me, are visible. So it doesn't have to be at schools. It's what your culture, what your art, you know, what your writers actually show and speak and are there and still standing there.
That's right. And I think it's like most of whatever I do, and it seems like what you do too, is there is something in mind that I want younger people, like my main audience, if I had to choose, there's many audiences, but there's one audience I had to choose, it would be the younger people who are growing up like I did, and I grew up in Saudi Arabia, right? So you can imagine. So the kids over there were growing up like me and looking at everything around them. They're like, oh, this is really weird, right? Those kids, they know that, okay, you know, there is somebody who's been through this and they have that experience. And I think that that's one thing that the young person who came to you was also thinking, that, you know, when he was younger and he was full of hate and he'd been given a certain societal or cultural narrative, and then he grew up watching you, he saw a completely different side of things from somebody who was also part of that community.
Yes.
Right? And that gives you, it gives you an option. It gives you an out. It starts to get you thinking, even if you initially react with anger.
Yeah. And you know, the very important thing is, because I have been doing this for 2 decades though, right?
Right.
And one of the things, you know, you've been taught that if you go this way, you will destroy your life. You know, you will just lose everything. No one will care for you. You will be totally alone. So it's more important as a grown-up woman now to be visible. You know, it's a strong message in I'm still here.
Yeah.
And I'm okay. I have dogs and cats. Okay, I didn't get kids. They told me that too. That happened. But I'm happy. I'm okay. I'm still doing my work. I'm still speaking, still writing. And it have been like 25 years. I'm still here. Yeah. And to be still there, to keep going, this is the way that you get there, that the next generation can actually come and see and say, and it's okay. So, you know, you show them the way, but you have to be there.
Yeah.
So too many people, you know, get tired.
They do.
Want to get into silent, or want to choose another work. Don't want all that attention, because it is tiring, you know?
It is, yeah. It must be. So I have a question to you. Like you famously, the way that you do things, there are layers to it. So you know how Sacha Baron Cohen, who's one of the greatest comedians alive ever, anytime he does something that's just funny, like Borat, just funny, immigrant guy, crazy things.
Yeah.
But he exposes layers of society, right? Like he exposes, for example, how people think of immigrants. Like an immigrant can come in, show them pictures of engaging in incest with their son, and they'd be like, oh, that's very nice. We just don't do that here, right? So that's the thing. They have this, okay, people overseas, they do whatever. You know, they it's the cultural relativism. He kind of exposes that in a way. And so you do similar things with your comedy in the sense that you take, you went up, you were in a public debate, I guess, with a mullah. Or I don't know if you were in public debate with him, but it was in public. And this
was actually promoting his book. It was a mullah who was accused for being a terrorist, and he was living as a refugee in Norway. So the Norwegian law was actually protecting him.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, he wrote a book, autobiography, you know, about his life.
Right.
And and he was really famous in Norway. He was the most famous accused to be terrorist mullah. So. But the launch of his book was at a nightclub. And there were going to be a debate about his book, and there was a very skeptic audience there. I was just passing by. This wasn't planned. And I saw this poster outside this nightclub that Mullah Krekar is going to be there. And, you know, I was doing my comedy, having this reaction, and my first thought was a mullah in a nightclub. Wow, what a sensation. I just went in there. And the atmosphere there were full of fear. People were sitting like this. It was packed. But this mullah was smiling, and he said, he's not a danger for the Norwegian society. I'm a good man, and this is Sharia. This is my beliefs. And his wife was also there in full hijab and full covered. But there were people between the audience were having their beers and wines and watching this. It was a really weird scene. So he was trying to convince the Norwegian audience that he isn't a danger for Norway's security. And so this was just, you know, intuitive thought I got where I lifted my hand first and said, I can help you to see if you're a dangerous man or not.
Yeah.
And he said yes, because they opened for questions. So I went on the stage and I put my arms around him and I lifted him up. And it was like 4 seconds.
Just lifted him off the ground.
Off the ground. And it was a really childish thing to do. And the layers, you know, it wasn't even anything like an immigrant comedy. It wasn't anything like taking the prejudges or something. It just happened there and then. And on his way up, he was smiling. But up there, the people with all that skepticism, they started to laugh, instantly laugh, just off the picture of he's being lifted. So when he realized that everybody's laughing, I could feel that he went into totally fear himself. Mm-hmm. He went totally, you know, like this. And then I gently put him down. And then he went totally crazy. He said that. Yeah, but he said, the first thing he said was, why didn't she kiss me? And people are, what? Yeah, but yeah, I have analyzed that. he said, why didn't she kiss me? And he said, this is not right. A woman shouldn't do that. So in that line, why didn't she kiss me? He was actually saying that he think that this lifting thing was, you know, a sexual offend.
Yeah.
It was a nice way to see why didn't she kiss me.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And that was the police report when he made the day after. It was sexual offense done by me.
Yeah.
And because for his belief, touching a strange man like this was offensive, really offensive.
Was there like a, well, I know what would have happened today if you'd done that. There would everybody be talking about consent and, you know, you held him and you picked him up and there was no consent. What do you say to people who say that? That, okay, well, you know, you lifted him alone without his consent and you went and you touched him without his consent.
Well, in the Norwegian debate, what people said was that the left wings and the right wings said totally different things about the lifting. It went, you know, world around. It was a world around news. So the left wing said that you should have respected his culture. You behaved like a bad Norwegian comedian.
You're from the same culture, though.
I know. I know. Then I just suddenly became a white, crazy, disrespectful comedian. But the right wing said, after you lifted him, you should have thrown him out of the country. Why is this shit man here? I was like, and I think both sides was wrong. And the layers came on how people were debating this. And I don't know if I could do this today, you know, with all this cancel culture and all these things happening now. But many of my stunts, which I have done during the, for 10 years ago, it will not be done today either easily.
Well, probably not easily, but that's the whole, look, the thing with comedy is that you're not supposed to do things that are easy. I mean,
that's true.
You have to, I think that this is, look, this
but
all.
You have to do this.
All this cancel culture stuff, I mean, you. It's on Twitter, right? I mean, you know, if anybody, if Susan B. Anthony was on Twitter and she said, oh, I think women should have the right to vote, she would be canceled at the time. Like anything that has been transformative in history, anything that has brought about a lot of change, those people, they tried to cancel them, but you just keep pushing on. So you did another sort of comedic stunt, right?
Yeah.
And you mooned the audience.
I mooned the audience on stage. I was wearing a very nice Pakistani suit.
You were wearing shalwar kameez, yes.
Yes, shalwar kameez, and I was really proud. I think I was really nice in that suit. What happened then? I was invited to open a Norwegian-Pakistani movie. It was the first time Norwegians and Pakistani have made a movie together. And I think it was lovely that I was invited. I felt that finally I was, you know, getting into the warm.
Yeah.
And it was a huge event. It was like the Norway's Oscar.
Yeah.
So it was like 1,000 people, you know, at the audience. And they were really, really proud. And it was a superstar actor from Pakistan. I can't remember his name, but he was playing the father in that movie. Yeah. So it was about love marriage between a Norwegian guy and a Pakistani girl and in Norway. So I was really excited, and I had to see the movie before, you know, it opened, and I was shocked. I was really shocked because the solution in that movie was that the Norwegian guy, he had to convert to her religion. He had to circumcise himself, and he had to write his signature under a contract that if he ever thought about divorce, the father has the right to kill him. And he signed. And he had to do all that stuff, and then he got the bride.
Okay, so that was a plot.
I'm not kidding. That was the script.
Oh, God.
So I don't know, how would you have opened this movie? And the female character, she had no lines, almost no lines. She was just happy that she got her sweetheart at the end.
Yeah.
So I just had to say something, and I felt so bad because it was the first time. It was all this party, and everybody was applauding that, oh, we are making movie together. So I felt so bad. What can should I, you know, cancel the job? So I just went up on stage and I said, you know what? In movies, maybe Pakistani girls are like this, accepting all that. But in real life, we are not. And then I turned and I mooned the audience.
Yeah. In shalwar kameez.
In front of the Pakistani superstar who was, who was playing the part. And you know what? What provoked me to do that? One thing was this crazy script, but the other thing was an interview this Pakistani superstar have given, and he was a well-established actor in Pakistan. To a Norwegian film magazine, he said that art should never challenge the society's moral. Never.
Oh God, that's such bullshit.
And he wasn't, you know, receiving one single critical question, saying this in Ibsen's homeland. Oh my God.
Yeah.
And not one critical question. So you would have mooned too.
Yeah, if I mooned, then that would be terrorism. I think that, you know, that would be a form. Yeah, but the...
Not in my book.
the great thing, I think, look, the reason this is... Your position actually allows you to, it actually gives you more power and makes you a more powerful figure is because you're from that community. So when you lift up Mullah Krekar, that's his name, right? Krekar?
Mm-hmm.
So when you lift him up off the ground, he can't complain that he was being harassed by some white Norwegian, you know, colonialist overlord, right? He can't say that because you are a girl from Karachi, right? And this is what you did to a mullah. When you go and you moon the audience in shalwar kameez, they can't say this is, you know, the West is trying to insult our culture. And they can't do that because, you know, you are a girl from Karachi, right?
True, it's there. But you know what? Even all this is there, giving me more space, you know, to explore. Yeah. But even though, you know, what happened after that mooning, the same night, I still... to this day don't know who did this, but a car passed by my sister's restaurant and shot 18 gunshots at the restaurant the same night. But the That was one thing. But what happened is when the morning after, I was, you know, surrounded by like 100 journalists. And the question they asked me, and I can still never forget what they did, because we were talking about, you know, we were talking about what our community says to brothers, see what your sisters are doing. But what the Norwegian journalists did, they went to my brother and wanted to ask my mother, do you think your sisters went too far? And I was thinking that if a Norwegian comedian mooned, would they have gone to his sister or brother or her mother and asked that question? They did it to me because they behaved like the Pakistani community, and that was Norwegian journalists.
There, it is. That's how pernicious this whole thing is. It's just really, really, wow. I mean, but so that once, but this is the thing. Like the one snot, people might say, okay, you know, when you moon the audience, you know, it's just only shock value. But whenever you do these things, you expose.
Yes.
Right. You expose these layers of society. So not only do you expose the Pakistani hypocrisy, you also expose the way that you were raised and how you tried to bust out of it. But then you also expose how much the Norwegian journalists have internalized this sort of like patriarchal aspect of Pakistani and Islamic culture. Right.
So that was my line. I said, I didn't strip my ass. I stripped your attitude.
Okay, I can't say anything better than that. I think you just end this right here with that. Yeah, I didn't just strip my ass. I stripped your attitude. So,
but you know, Ali, I survived all this. I still did comedy. I went to exile in New York for some years after the gun shots, and I went back home to Norway. I continued my life. But today I am concerned, not because of me, but because of the lack of guts for the next generation. And the last year I have been working with teenagers to with comedy, you know, to coach them on comedy. And I was surprised that there is also a new generation who have been smitten by this cancel culture, or the way they have taught themselves how their identity should be as minorities. Some of them actually say openly, we don't like irony. Some of them said irony is racist. You know, it's like they don't, it's like someone who don't want to read, to teach how to read and write. They don't want to have anything to do with humor. Because they want to be this serious identity victims.
And they believe what are they doing in a comedy class then? Why are they getting coached in comedy?
The thing is, they what they did was to be there and to decide the script, decide who are going to work on it, and to attack the teenagers who actually were open for comedy. So it went, you know, they at the school we were working on, they actually started campaign against their own comedy. And that is concerning me. That is really concerning. And I don't know where that are erasing from.
Do you, so this do you think is, is social media and the fact that we're seeing it rather than a new phenomenon? And I mean that honestly. Like, you know, there was a time when, you know, we've had controversial comedians in the past, you know, from Lenny Bruce, Richard Pryor, you know, Carlin, Eddie Murphy, Woody Allen, like all of these people were, you know, they caused stirs and issues in their own way, right? And the only thing is everybody who was angry at them, they had to write to the editor at a paper, and the editors could choose whatever they wanted to publicize. But now every critic has a Twitter account and an Instagram. Right? Do you think that is what it is, or do you think it's it is genuinely a new phenomenon? Because, you know, people have been getting offended for the longest time, right? It's just
that's not something new.
Yeah, go on.
It's not something new, but what is new is that we are now dealing with people who have this victim power, because they are victimizing themselves as of being offended. Everyone can be offended. I think it's a human right to say that I'm offended. It's okay. But the thing is that you victimize yourself and you use that power to censor other people. And that has grown in a way which is out of control. And I think they are spoiled. It's a spoiled nation who didn't really experience, you know, what violence is, what racism is, what offense is. Yeah. It's like they have victimized this glamorous. They have victimized. Now they have glamorized victimization, and it's become their identity. And they are, you know, full of power. Being power sick of that, and they are using it. I know people who have lost their jobs, who have been scared away from their social networks, who have been went into silent because of these campaigns. So they are powerful. We can not just say that, oh, there are some crazy stuff going on. We have to deal with this.
Yeah, no, we have to. But I think that one of the reasons that they're powerful now is that they actually have, everybody has a platform, mm-hmm. right? Everybody has a platform. So the same people who at that time were just sort of these fringe voices that we could brush away, now you can't as easily, because you're right, people are losing jobs mm-hmm. and so on. This reminds me of, you know, when you're talking about the victimization, the victim mentality, Stephen Fry has mm-hmm. talked about how self-pity and victimization, and I'm paraphrasing him, is one of the most malignant forms of narcissism, right? Mm. Because it gives you an excuse to focus all your attention on yourself. Mm-hmm. When you're feeling sorry for yourself, when you think you're the victim, it gives you an excuse to just focus on your misery and what you went through and completely shut out everybody else. And when you're feeling sorry for yourself and you're engaged in self-pity, then you can also blame others for not feeling sympathy for you.
Yeah.
It is the ultimate and the most pernicious form of narcissism that there is. Right. Yeah. And this is something I wish more people would talk about. But how do you combat it? Don't you, like, to me, whenever I've seen this stuff, whenever I've seen cancel culture and all that, when they tell you you can't draw cartoons of Muhammad, anything like that, it just makes me want to do it more. I don't look at my Twitter notifications. The more people get pissed off, the more it energizes me. If I believe in what I'm doing,
the problem is you have to keep fighting for some stages, even if it's your column in a newspaper or your book or your podcast. And be visible. But the problem I see arising now is that if you got this victim identity or narcissistic identity, you know, get to the press with them and even politicians with them, you know, to mm-hmm. that's what I see, these things happening, growing in Norway, where it's becoming popular to support these voices, and therefore it become more powerful. To be a totally free voice in a growing environment like this, it's hard, and it's going to be hard. Mm-hmm. I just started a podcast. Mm-hmm. I will still be writing. I'm visiting you and speaking about this.
Yeah.
That's what I can do. But also, I have lost my jobs. Also, I have been experienced canceling. Mm-hmm. Also, I have heard or write on my face that just because you are brown, you don't have a free pass to be a racist. So it's there. And it's that's why I'm concerned. How can we coach and teach the next generation about what comedy is in an environment like this?
But you should write a whole. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I just want to say that I don't wish my worst enemies to be like this either.
I actually think, you know, that line, if someone says, oh, just because you're brown doesn't mean you can't be racist. I think it'd be great to just write a comedy bit on why, yes, it does. It does give you a right to be racist, actually. And here
you're
are the
right.
You know,
it's a great idea.
Yeah, it's good. Write a good, like, nice 4 or 5 minute bit and just make it absolutely hilarious. Why you know, it's good to be racist. I might actually do that. I don't know.
We should write it together.
yeah, we should. So what's next for you? I wanted to also mention, I mean, if you guys want to go, everybody's listening, if you want to go and look up Shabana's stuff online, it's there. There's one of the most powerful clips that you have. And before we go, we only have like 6-7 minutes left. So I wanted to make sure that I mentioned this is when you were up, I think, doing a talk and you had the Quran with you. And you were talking about burning the Quran. And you said you lit the match. And you were about to burn it. And then, I don't know, do you want to tell it or?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. And I think that have English subtitles as well. Are you there? I think I lost you.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, but you can see me?
I can see you, yes. You can't see me.
I can't, but I will try to find you anyway. But yeah. The stunt is... threatening to not burn the Quran.
Yeah.
And it was this was a stunt with many layers, because the fourth story for that was I think there was a Norwegian officer in Afghanistan who was killed after an American pastor or something burned a Quran. So there were demonstrations in Afghanistan where several people were killed, and one of them was a Norwegian officer. So I was invited to open the literature festival in Norway, where the theme was dangerous books. Mm-hmm. And my point was, when I lifted up the Quran, and I find the biggest, matches. It's called matches, you know. I found. The message was for everyone now in our time, this is world's most dangerous books. And if I burn this book now and I hold it, and the amazing thing was the reaction of the audience. They get this painful face looks. It was like someone's hurting them there and then, just of the line that if I burn the Quran. They were like hiding themselves, like I'm going to explode a bomb or something. They have physical reaction at the audience. And then I said, if I burn this book, it will become more dangerous. So I wouldn't. Mm-hmm. I knew that just holding the Quran and not burning it will provoke the real fanatics, you know? And it did. It did. Why are you holding the Quran? And even in Norwegian newspaper, they said Shabana is provoking people by burning the Quran stunt.
Yeah.
And I said, no, it was not burning the Quran stunt. And that's what comedians have to say. Reach out their message and, you know, provoke out the trolls and expose them. Stunt did that.
Yeah, you held up the Quran. You were about to, it's like, it looked like you were about to burn it on stage. The entire audience was freaking out. You had the match lit and the fire close to it. And then I think you blew it out, or you did. You said, no, I'm not going to do this, because if I do this, this is going to give it power. It's going to make it even more dangerous.
Power.
Yeah. And it's that was so brilliant.
Yeah.
Like everything. So to be able to use, sorry, go ahead.
It's the whole thing as a comedian you know, to find ways to say what you want to say without being beheaded. And that's our challenge, and have always been our challenge.
Yeah, this is, I mean, again, there's a lot of, I think, people who take this stuff superficially. They just do shock humor for the sake of shock humor, just because they think pissing people off is the only goal. And there's nothing wrong with pissing people off. But when you do it, when you're doing it, and there's a purpose, and there's a message, and there's a lesson in there, it's more powerful than any, sort of, I think, any op-ed or any book or any article in any magazine or any live intellectual debate in a university, because people are not ideologically, you know, it breaks down their guard, their ideological prejudices. It breaks it down, and it makes it more, makes them more receptive when they're experiencing things in that way.
I think therefore it's so important that we have so many comedians as we could with Muslim background, because there are challenges in the Muslim societies, because there are so much censored there. You know, because we have the opportunity to go on deeper levels, you know, to express the comedy, to say, tell the truth, and do it, like you said, in that way that if you laugh, you understand.
Yeah. So we're up to an hour now. We're at time, and I wish I could talk to you for way, way longer than this. And hopefully we'll do this again at some point if you have time. But
I would love to.
I have just two more things to ask you. Number one is, what are your biggest comedic influences? When you look back with other comedians, who are some of the people who you think are the greatest that inspired you?
I have been searching, you know, for comedians who inspire me, because being so hunted. But I have seen, I like the story of Lenny Bruce. I love Charlie Chaplin. And there is an American lady, I can't come up with her name now, but she was like in the 50s. I really like to see the first comedians, you know, who were taboo breaking more than today's comedians. I have been finding inspiration by going back in time.
Yeah, I suppose like when I think of taboo breaking comedians, I think a lot of Richard Pryor, just because.
Yeah, of course.
Because he was.
Yeah, I love the thing that there are no niggers in Africa.
Yeah, I know. It's like the stuff that he and you know, the way that he did his background, actually, his life story was incredible, because he was born to a prostitute, right? And was kind of grew up in a brothel. And then he just made this black man who just grew up and became this absolute icon, such a pioneer. And
he was born to a prostitute. That's the main theme in many Bollywood movies, you know?
Yeah.
And I've been reflecting on that, because prostitutes are a way in many Bollywood films to show scenes, you know, with dancing, with more freely culture, or with the main character being a son of a prostitute or something. And I find it very interesting, because then you have, you know, you have your shit, and you have to, you can say thing and explore thing more freely, because of the prostitution or tawaif or whatsoever, because there are people like they really are, because the sexual boundaries are so strong and so killing that many movie script has to go, you know, to the whorehouses to express scenes they could.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. The last, Shabana, what is next for you? Just quickly, what's next for you, and where can people find you?
Online. You can find me online. There are many YouTube videos. There are some with English subtitles, but there are also some English-speaking shows I did in New York. But you can find me on my homepage, shabana.no. I am at social media. I am at Twitter. Please feel free to take contact and share your thoughts.
Yeah, so on Twitter, you're Shabana Rehman. That's Shabana Rehman, correct?
Yes, yeah. Correct. And okay. I'm on Instagram also, at Shabana Rehman 76.
Perfect. Okay. So everyone's going to find it. If anybody who's listening to this, if you like this, just make sure you go to secularjihadist.com and subscribe. If you want to watch the video version of this, if you're listening to this, you want to watch the video version, go and subscribe. There's loads of videos with not only Shmara, but other comedians like the one I mentioned, Muhammad, like Jaffer Khan, like Vidu Vids, and then, you know, many, many other people. So, absolutely consider becoming a patron. But anyway, Shabana, thank you. And yeah, everybody else, make sure you click subscribe and hit the bell and, you know, all that stuff. Usually Armin does this and, you know, so now I'm doing it. I'm not as good at it as he is. But Shabana, thank you so much. It's been such an honor. This has been so much fun. Hopefully when the pandemic is over, we can hang out in person again like we did in Amsterdam.
Yeah, I would love to.
There were so many people there and I wanted to actually... I was hoping to talk to you more, but it was just so many people at that conference. So hopefully, you know.
I was hoping to see you again. So this was a nice opportunity. Thank you, Ali. Thank you.
We should do this more. Thank you. Okay, so have a great rest of the day. And hopefully we'll have you back on to talk and just talk comedy again. It'd be great.
Keep in touch. Okay. Bye-bye.
The Secular Jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends, write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions, or head over to secularjihadists.com and give a dollar or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the Flying Spaghetti Monster be with you.